Jenny Mack with your daily comedy news. Today, I feel like talking about Mitch Hedberg. I don't need the filler. I just haven't talked about Mitch in a while. So I pulled together a few stories and I thought I'd talk about Mitch. So one thing I can tell you is I know exactly where I was on March 31st, 2005. Here's why. I was at the New York City Javits Center doing an episode of Jim Brewer's radio show for SiriusXM. We were broadcasting from the car show, and Jim was in a bad mood because the night before, Jim was doing a concert with Mitch Hedberg, and Mitch did not show up. And Jim was kind of annoyed because he had to stretch and fill because the other comedian didn't show up. And Jim wound up doing an extra 40 minutes or an hour or whatever was the story there. And Jim was quite upset about it. As we were doing the broadcast from the car show, we got word there was a reason Mitch Hedberg didn't show up for that show. He had passed away the night before. Mitch Hedberg passed away March 30th, 2005 in Livingston, New Jersey, not far from where I live. So we were like, oh, that kind of changed the mood several ways. One, we felt like we were being a bunch of jerks for being mad at the guy not showing. Two, we all love Mitch Hedberg, and holy cow, he had passed away. From personal experience, I knew at the radio station that I wanted to do a tribute to Mitch Hedberg, but I don't like being a vulture. So I didn't want to like the next day be like, oh, we got to do a Mitch Hedberg tribute because then we make it about us. So we waited and I eventually reached out to Mitch's wife, Lynn Shawcroft, and I'm like, hey, would love to do a tribute to Mitch. Would you be into that? She was into it. She came by. I got to know Lynn reasonably well. And when she came up, she had Mitch's notebooks with some jokes and a bunch of, I think they were cassettes. They might have been CDs, but they were live shows recorded late in Mitch's career. And I was sitting there with Lynn and she hadn't heard them in a while and they sounded great. And I said to her, you know, you've got another album here. That album became the posthumous Mitch Hedberg album, Do You Believe in Gosh? I had nothing to do with making the album other than possibly, perhaps, putting the thought in Lynn's brain. I'm glad that that album was released. From a 2013 article in GQ, GQ wrote, Mitch Hedberg was Twitter before Twitter. His jokes were short, inane, and timeless. He was on the road doing stand-up 300 nights a year, living off vending machines, writing constantly about the world he saw around him. Mike Birbiglia said, Mitch wrote some of the best jokes of the last three decades. He's one comedian who all comedians agree is great. Mitch was never without a pen, never threw away a notebook. Lynn Shawcroft kept most of the notebooks private, but back in 2013, she opened them up to GQ. GQ wrote the results, a masterclass in comedy. There was only one time Mitch ever lost a notebook. He and Lynn were in Chicago. They'd gotten back to their hotel when Mitch noticed it was missing. He tore through the hotel room looking for it. Lynn said it was one of the only times I saw him really visibly upset about something. Finally, after a while, he started telling himself, it's fine, everything will be fine. That's when the phone rang. It was a kid at a frat party. Apparently, Mitch had left the notebook on stage. Somehow, it ended up in the hands of a college-age fan who wanted to give it back. Mitch and Lynn headed to the party to meet the kid. When they got there, a relieved Mitch pulled out a wad of cash, tried to hand it to the kid. The kid didn't want any money. He just wanted Mitch to call him to hang out next time he was in town. But by then, it was already 5 and 6 in the morning, and Mitch hated to feel indebted to people. He finally looked at the kid and said, just take the effing money, man. Lynn says, Mitch's jokes were about our life. He wrote about what he liked, so his jokes were about sandwiches and carrots and staying in hotels and the weird ways language works. Now, this next thing, I remember Lynn telling this to me when we were listening to the tapes I referred to earlier. We were in one of the smaller studios at Sirius, and she pointed out, during Mitch's stand-up, people would call out the endings before he could finish them. He was having a tough time touring because of that. So Lynn says, later in his career, he had to write jokes that were even shorter and faster. Examples, when someone tries to hand me out a flyer, it's just like saying, here, you throw this away. Or a turtleneck's like being strangled by a really weak guy all day. Mitch knew what else connected with his audience, drug jokes. There were dozens. I like the FedEx driver because he's a drug dealer. He doesn't even know it. He's always on time. People associate long hair with drug use. I wish long hair was associated with something other than drug use, like an extreme longing for cake. And then strangers would see a long-haired guy and say, that guy eats cake. He's on bundt cake. Mothers saying to their daughters, don't bring the cake eater over here anymore. He smells like flour. See how excited he got when he found out your birthday was fast approaching? At one point, Mitch started writing companies he liked looking for sponsorships. In addition to Gold Bond, he wrote to Uniball to say the jokes he wrote with their pens were funnier. Eventually, Jimmy John's The Sandwich Makers signed on to sponsor Mitch Hedberg. From The Guardian in 2015, Mitch Hedberg, a sly alchemist who turns sentences into comedy gold. From behind sunglasses and bowed head, Mitch Hedberg delivered concise gags that open up the mundane world and showed anyone could be a comedian. If you're flammable and have legs, you're never blocking a fire exit. That's the line that got the writer hooked on Mitch Hedberg, a man standing still on a stage with his eyes shut, mic in the stand, reciting a list of staccato jokes with a percussive rhythm. It seemed odd. I'd never heard one-liners before which had no hint of punslinging or wordplay, just funny sentences. I guess the writer hadn't heard Stephen Wright. Believe me, I'm a huge Mitch Hedberg fan, but there's surely some Stephen Wright influence in there. Mitch was a drug user, something which caused his death in 2005, but listening to him didn't sound like the ramblings of a typical stoner, but instead the thoughts of someone unencumbered by the conventional logic that gradually takes us over as we succumb to adulthood. Watching Mitch allowed you to feel like a child again, and although cats and hamburgers aren't important, finding humor in the mundane is. Jokes such as, if you live with a monster, you'd never get the hiccups, require a sense of thought, but having been in his presence for 2 minutes allowed you to think with the Hedbergian logic, or is it Hedbergian? How would you pronounce that word? I'm going with Hedbergian. Sounds cooler. Hedbergian logic that guide you seamlessly to the funny. The joke is just 10 words long, but 10 words was enough for Hedberg to paint a hilarious and detailed picture that most people couldn't paint with 100. However, the audience aren't just laughing at the painting, but the man with the brush and their own incredulity that a single person is able to have all these thoughts which don't make you just say, I've never thought of that in a way before, but instead, I've never thought about anything like that ever. His long hair often obscured his bowed, sunglassed face. He never showed dominance over the stage by pacing. His hands would often be held still behind his back. He seemed shy, but this made him far more relatable than any confident comedian who chats to audiences with the unfettered glances of an old mate. Most audience members know they don't possess the requisite skills to talk on a stage as confidently such as greats like Steve Martin or Sarah Silverman, so Mitch Hedberg's demeanor made him far more human to many people. He made me realize you don't need great performance skills or an ability to write seamless segues to be a comedian. If the sentences you're saying are funny, people will laugh. His untimely passing means we'll never know what one of the most inventive and prolific writers in comedy could have eventually achieved, but watching a handful of his YouTube clips makes it clear he created more laughs and jokes in his one short life than many other comedians could hope to create in two. In 2011, Deadspin wrote, by all accounts, Mitch Hedberg was a pretty regular guy. He grew up in St. Paul, Minnesota, before he ditched the suburbs, literally leaving his parents' home without telling them after high school graduation because he didn't know how to tell them he was going. I met Mitch's parents at the Las Vegas Comedy Festival. Oh, it's got to be 15 years ago now. They were so nice. Mitch eventually surfaced in Fort Lauderdale, eventually taking up kitchen work and trying his hand unsuccessfully at open mic comedy nights in the area. He begged his way onto MTV's short-lived Kamikaze. I didn't know that. And even though the show didn't last, Hedberg was on his way. In 96, he appeared on Letterman. Wow, that long ago? Wow. 97, he won the grand prize at the Seattle Comedy Competition. In 98, he stole the show at the Just for Laughs Festival in Montreal. Hedberg developed a style of awkward, scattershot, observational jokes that weren't exactly one-liners. He was a minimalist, sure, but he was working on another level than, say, Henny Youngman. His jokes weren't just riffs on existing tropes. The only norm Hedberg adhered to was that there weren't any norms. His humor never met you halfway. He pulled listeners into his own head. His delivery was as off-putting as his material. His was the sort of art that elicits a, huh, wow, as opposed to a, wow, huh? That was his brilliance. The obvious point of comparison is with Stephen Wright, and again on paper, the two comics seem to share a lot in common, but where Wright was a comic golem, an android programmed to tell off-putting jokes, Hedberg was, in an odd way, emotionally accessible. As offbeat as much of his jokes were, they presented in the manner of an oddball childhood friend you hadn't seen in years. Though dressed in the garb of turn-of-the-century hipster, Hedberg's jokes were decisively unironic. He wasn't engaging in social commentary or wry negativity as much as he was bearing his weirdo soul. The stoner label's inaccurate, but even the occasional drug user could identify Hedberg was you, high, thinking you're funny, but actually being funny. And that's how he won us over. The way he stood on stage, eyes closed, sunglasses on, bangs over his face, halfway trembling. He told Joel Stein in 1998, I don't like to connect with the crowd. I find if you look at people's faces, you see a disappointed face. He said, sometimes in the middle of the night, I think of something that's funny. I go get a pen, write it down. Or if the pen's too far away, I have to convince myself that what I thought of ain't funny. He broke the fourth wall repeatedly in an attempt to reposition himself from alone on stage to seated among the audience. That's like a carbon copy of the previous joke, but with different ingredients. I don't know what I was trying to pull off there. That joke made me laugh before I could finish it, which is good, because there's no ending. All right. Oh, he was so good. Once, when being handed a drink mid-joke, a joke that was foundering anyway. He just cut the joke off and said, that'll F up a joke about effing up an effed up joke. After he broke out at Just for Laughs, Hedberg got a $500,000 development deal with Fox. He appeared on Letterman a few more times. He financed his own movie, a subtle tribute to his restaurant days called Los Enchiladas. His next paragraph has a couple jokes that I don't remember hearing. Deadspin writes, with disarming subtlety, he deconstructed the stand-up form by taking on hackneyed subjects and turning them on their head, or by bombing deliberately. I play sports. No, I don't. What the F? Remember that show, My Three Sons? It'd be funny if it was called My One Dad. Wait, what? I just bought a two-bedroom house, but I think I get to decide how many bedrooms there are, don't you? In the context of trippy non sequiturs about koala infestations and potato chips, this came off as subversive. He was blowing himself up, along with everyone in the room. The self-destruction extended to his personal life. At first, it seemed if Hedberg's riffing on his drug use was more of a dig at his stage persona. My manager saw me backstage and said, Mitch, don't use liquor as a crutch. I can't use liquor as a crutch because a crutch helps me walk. Liquor severely F's up the way I walk. Some people think I'm high on stage. I would never get high before a show because when I'm high, I don't want to stand in front of a bunch of people I don't know. For stretches, he lived off the grid, living out of hotels or out of the RV he bought with Lynn Shawcroft. In May 2003, after a show in Austin, Mitch was arrested for possession of a controlled substance. He spent 2.5 days in jail, followed by 6 months in a hospital, supposedly for the treatment of a leg badly mangled by heroin injections. Toward the end of his life, he'd walk on stage with two plastic cups that were widely known to contain alcohol, and at least one specifically identified as screwdrivers. Hedberg had killer sets and less successful sets. Some lacked verve, some lacked direction. Sometimes he couldn't remember the jokes at all. Sometimes his fans would holler out the jokes he was trying to tell to help him out. It was interactive stand-up. Even on the good nights, people sung along to the choruses that often step on his punchlines. Hedberg had so fully seduced his fans that the division between stage and seats fell away. Didn't you ever hear of dramatic pause? He'd sometimes grouch. But that was the point. His fans weren't attuned to the artifice of performance so much as they were there for communion. And let's wrap with an album review from 2008 from the Washington Post. This the review of the posthumous Do You Believe in Gosh? A stand-up performance recorded 2 months before Hedberg's death. The album has funny moments, but listeners familiar with the comedian's personal history may find that Hedberg's troubled specter looms over the proceedings. Do You Believe in Gosh? Does include bits on anchovies and carrot juice, but Hedberg also delves into darker subject matter. He seems particularly fixated on missing body parts, with references to amputation, a woman born without arms, an extended bit on the headless horseman. Granted, the material's more silly than morbid. I'd hate to be the headless horseman's dentist. You wouldn't make very much money. He also delves into his professional life, saying, I got a door deal here. Tonight I'm working for 50% of the door. Then tomorrow I'm working for 50% of the door. And then on Sunday, I'm going to have a door. Since the album comprises a seemingly unedited live show, the 40-minute runtime includes at least as much laughter and applause as it does Mitch Hedberg. His reactions to the audience are sometimes as funny as his jokes. At one point, he trails off, then assures the audience, trust me, it's hilarious. Get into my head and come back out and tell me I'm wrong. Towards the end of the performance, self-consciousness seems to win out over the professed confidence, as Hedberg refers to his jokes as half there or needing work. In some cases, he's correct, but we'll never hear the fully realized versions. The Washington Post wrote, the album's strange poignancy may be best captured by one of Hedberg's typically absurd setups. I want to ride in a cold air balloon. I'm afraid of heights. I don't want to leave here. Well, then take a ride in my cold air balloon, because we ain't effing going anywhere. And that's your comedy news for today. Mitch Hedberg, one of the greats. Follow the show on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Good Pods, wherever you get your shows. All right.